Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Molly Wheeler, and I will be the host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 55 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The Hinckley Institute of Politics proudly presents the 17th Annual Rocco C. and Marion S. Siciliano Forum. This year's theme is the future of U.S.-Latin American relations. This is one of 21 events that conclude today. And for a listing of all the previous events we've had, we encourage you to visit our website as well. The title of today's forum is The Future of U.S.-Mexican Relations, and Alice Zapata will be introducing our guest. He was born in Los Angeles, California, and attended local schools and colleges in the Los Angeles area. He received an Associate of Arts from East Los Angeles College, a Bachelor of Arts in Industrial Psychology, a Master of Arts in Public Administration, and completed coursework for his PhD in International Political Economics from the University of Southern California. He graduated from Harvard Graduate School of Business and the Inter-American Defense College, the National War College in Washington, D.C. He speaks Spanish fluently and has an elementary knowledge of French. Presently, Al is the president and CEO of the United States Mexico Chamber of Commerce and is responsible for operations in 8 regional offices in the United States and 9 in Mexico. Please join me in welcoming Al.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's kind of interesting to come back and spend some time with good friends that I want to first thank, because we probably wouldn't be if it wasn't for these gentlemen, most specifically my chairman emeritus of our board, Stuart Dye, who happens to be also a member of your esteemed university's senior advisory council.
National advisory.
I want to get it right, Stuart. Also, mi consul, Eduardo, gracias por todo, huh? Por toda tu ayuda y vamos juntos en esta, nuestro capítulo. Gracias. We have a great consul general, by the way, that those of you that have met him know what I'm talking about, but how many speak Spanish here? Okay, well, then I'm okay. You probably understood what I said then.
Yeah.
And those of you that are deficit, get to sit next to one of the ones that had their hands up. But also, a friend that I've really grown to respect and know, and every time I look up, I see him looking right at me. What a great artist rendition of you, Kurt Dower. Thank you for having us. And Derek Miller, when you were with the governor, you were very, very supportive, and I want to thank you. And now that we have a chance to really work together as head of the International Trade, is it Center? Am I correct? Okay, and so we look forward to that. But let me take a moment, and just before I introduce a friend, un buen amigo de muchos años. Some of you may or may not know the U.S.-Mexico Chamber of Commerce, and we'll be having our inaugural dinner tonight to really kick off the what we call the Rocky Mountain chapter of the U.S.-Mexico Chamber of Commerce, 44-year-old chamber that is binational. Our membership and our board of directors are Mexican major corporate executives and CEOs on both sides. Our first chairman was David Rockefeller in 1973, and Miguel Alemán, who's now still our honorary chairman in Mexico. So there's a long history of U.S. and Mexican business that have come together and worked together also with the governments of Mexico and the U.S. We're now focused in a post-NAFTA era, and the question earlier this morning was a question about where do we go and what are we doing about the next round of trade. Well, I present to you that we here are very fortunate, you here in Utah, because when you look at what we call in the international political economics sphere, core and periphery, we're in the core. And the core is made up of North America, from the Arctic to the Panama Canal, Canada, U.S., Mexico, that made up NAFTA and continue. So when you look at that, we are the largest trading bloc on the globe. So when you then look at Asia Pacific and Europe, you then have a sense of how important we are and where we are and how the future looks. And especially those of you here in Utah and the young students that are here, I think you have a great opportunity to link as we go forward. Okay, that's enough of my, infomercial about the chamber, but we're going to be here. You'll meet some of the people here that are representing us, and we'll be heading up our chapter here. But let me first introduce you to Ambassador Alejandro Estivill Castro. The ambassador has a very unique position because he's what we call the DCM, or Deputy Chief of Mission, or Chargé d'Affaires, in the Washington, D.C., Mexico office of the ambassador to the White House, our good friend Eduardo Medina Mora, who happens to be, and we have a history of the two ambassadors, Tony Wayne in Mexico representing the U.S., and Eduardo Medina Mora on the Mexican side, as honorary presidents of our chamber. And that's been our history since the beginning. And so we're very fortunate to have Ambassador Estivill Castro because he is actually in a very unique position for the second time. First time was in London when he was working with, again, Ambassador to London on behalf of Mexico, Eduardo Medina Mora, who is now the U.S. Representative, or the Mexican representative in the U.S., who is, as we speak, and he'll talk more about it, has a very special opportunity, shall I say, on behalf of President Peña Nieto, Enrique Peña Nieto. And so we're lucky to have a friend. Let me talk a little bit about him and his background. He is a member of the Foreign Service. He has served as special advisor to the Secretary of the Foreign Relations, political affairs attaché for the Mexican Embassy in Costa Rica, chief of staff for the Undersecretary of Foreign Relations, Enrique Beruga, director general for cultural affairs, and director general for North American affairs. Additionally, he worked in the Chargé d'Affaires and the Embassy of Mexico in the United Kingdom, Great Britain, Northern Ireland, and since January 20th of this year, he has been deputy head of mission of the Mexican Embassy in the United States of America, and that's in Washington, D.C. He holds a B.A. in Hispanic Literature from the National Autonomous University of Mexico, UNAM, and a Ph.D. in literature from El Colegio de México. And if you walk around with him, and we were looking at the history of Mexico and the revolution and the photos, you get a Ph.D.-level historic history lesson. So, Ambassador, gracias. On June 1st, 2012, the President Felipe Calderón appointed him Ambassador of Mexico with the rank that he will hold for life as a career member of the Mexican Foreign Service. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Ambassador Alejandro Estivill Castro.
Thank you. Thank you all. He's more than a friend. We met about 20 years, 15 years ago, I believe, when I was with Enrique Beruga at the time. And we had a friend in common that I want to remember now, Ambassador Carlos Rico, who was the Undersecretary of Foreign Affairs. And Carlos Rico all the time was telling me, please take care of Alzapan. Take care of Alzapanta. Take care of Alzapanta. You will never find a better cheerleader of Mexico-U.S. relationship than Alzapanta. And then he was thinking, maybe Bob Pastor, but Alzapanta. But you have been so keen for this relationship. Thank you all for this lovely presentation. Thank you for the Hinckley Institute. Really, it's very appealing to be with you. And, of course, to be in something called the Siciliano Forum that is so In Spanish, sounds terrific, really, to have to be in the Siciliano Forum to talk about Mexico-U.S. relations. Of course, Kirkle Jowers, thank you for hosting me, and new friends for like Stuart that I have met during this trip, and all the people of the University of Utah that have been so kind with me and gave me this opportunity of not only talking about Mexico, but learning more about Utah and how Utah is doing incredible things for the U.S. economy, for the Utah economy, and for Mexico, because you are an exemplary state in terms of what can be done in terms of a relationship with all those Mexicans and Hispanic origin people that is working here, but also in terms of trade, in terms of academic, in terms of students coming and going from one side to the other. It's very difficult, the task that I have here, to talk about the future of and answering Alza Panta's question, where should we go? I will try to address some of the subjects in a relationship that is so intense as no one, I believe, in the world. Enrique Berruga used to say that when an ambassador does not know what is happening between the country in which he's posted and his country, maybe he's not doing a bad job. Maybe he's doing a great job, because so much is happening that you start just looking the balls growing up your head from one side to the other. So maybe it's part of what is happening between Mexico and the U.S., but I will try to address some of the more important aspects. The future of U.S.-Mexico relations. I'll start with several simple but, I think, powerful concepts. Our vision for the future of our relationship is based, first and foremost, on our shared economic space and opportunities that constantly grow out of this reality. It is deeply linked to the conceptualization of North America as a region and an opportunity to have to turn North America into the most competitive region in the world through increased economic integration. As we speak, our countries are experiencing the fastest economic integration of any region in the world in every possible way. Last year, we celebrated NAFTA 20th anniversary, and rightly so, for it represented a big leap towards in the strategic outlook of the rules governing economic integration in North America. Intra-NAFTA trade today exceeds $1 billion. For the U.S. and Mexico, trade is more than six times what it was 20 years ago. Bilateral trade between Mexico and the United States has grown from about $80 billion in 1993 to more than $50 billion annually and growing towards the $600 billion from $80 billion to $500 billion, and it's going to $600 billion annually, which translates into approximately $1 billion per minute in trade. Mexico is now the third largest trading partner of the United States and its second largest export destination. 6 million jobs in the U.S. depend on exports to Mexico, and 55,000 jobs here in Utah are the result of our trade. During the last 20 years, Utah exports to Mexico have grown by 851%, and so today, Mexico has become Utah's largest trading partner, which close to $4 billion in trade last year. And is one that I would consider an emerging state in the relationship with Mexico. While the goal of NAFTA was the establishment of a free trade area, something much more significant has happened. North America has become a region of shared production. We are jointly producing goods through the deeply integrated production and supply chains that have developed as a result of the clear, stable, and transparent rules established by NAFTA. And we are increasingly engaging with the global economy as one region. The paradigmatic example of North American production is the auto industry, but the aerospace industry is also becoming increasingly regional. Bombardier, the Canadian aerospace company, is a good example of an integrated North American operation where design and manufacturing are shared among the three countries. Bombardier Aerospace manufactures the fuselage and cockpit of the Learjet 85 business jet in Querétaro, which uses Pratt and Whitney turbines made in Quebec, and final assembly takes place in Wichita, Kansas. Evidence of growing intra-regional investment can be seen in the percentage of U.S. value added in U.S. imports. It is 2% from Japan and from the European Union, 3% for imports from Brazil and 4% from Chinese imports. It is 25% for imports from Canada and 40%, I'm saying exactly this figure, 40% for imports from Mexico. This is to say U.S. imports from Mexico have 10 times more U.S. value added than U.S. imports from China. When you buy something from Mexico, you are buying something from the U.S., 40% of the U.S. Many of those numbers are encouraging, but if we are to take North American economic integration and competitiveness to the next level, we need to have much stronger and proactive engagement between the public and private sector and to truly think and act regionally. North America has the combination of geography, demographics. I heard Javier's presentation and was full of those demographics that show how important for our future is to think about demographics in regional terms, but also energy, resources, and other capabilities necessary to become the most competitive region of the world. Let me highlight some of the assets and opportunities we share and the areas where we must work harder to turn this future vision into reality. Estimates for the year 2050 say that the seven largest economy in the world will be first China, second the United States, third India, fourth Indonesia, fifth Brazil, sixth Japan, and seventh Mexico. Demographic estimates also say that by 2050, the U.S. will have the highest per capita GDP growth among major economies, and Mexico will lead average growth numbers among the major Latin American economies in per capita GDP. According to figures from the United Nations Population Division, in 2050, the North American region will have about 530 million inhabitants, more than the 454 million people who will be leaving the European Union. When we consider demographic indicators for Mexico and the U.S., we see better dependency ratios compared with Europe and younger population in North America comparatively with the European Union and, of course, of China. We anticipate that our region will have a demographic advantage, that our demographic profiles are complementary. In contrast to other countries in Europe and Asia, that will face serious challenges in declining total population and will have to sustain an aging population. In demographics, North America has one of its strongest assets. And I can say here that Utah is one of the examples of that. Some of the figures that show that the level of growth of the United States, that is at this moment two births for every woman, and in the case of Mexico is 2.3, 2.4, and in the case of the United States, the white population is 1.7. And the only growing population in general in the United States is 2.4 in the case of Hispanics. Here in Utah, it's much more balanced. It's the case of the whole United States where the growth of population is much more balanced. Let's go to energy. According to the latest BP Energy Outlook, by 2035, North America will be a net oil exporter, accounting for 6% of global energy exports. And by 2017, the region could become the net exporter of natural gas. North America will be the only region in the world over that period that moves from being a net energy importer to a net exporter. So while China and Europe become more dependent on energy imports, North America will become self-sufficient. North America, thus, has the necessary energy resources to fuel its economic growth for a long time. And reliable and affordable energy will be a key component in ensuring a very competitive North American manufacturing base. However, we cannot afford to take each other for granted precisely because of our high degree of interdependence and the great potential that still lies ahead. Two decades of increased trade and investment mean that there is so much more that needs to be done. The world economy has changed radically over the last two decades. Services loom more larger now, as does e-commerce, for example. And advanced manufacturing means that a highly skilled workforce, a streamlined regulation, and vastly improved infrastructure and logistics, both at border crossing and throughout North America, will be critically important to take full advantage of our economic complementarity. In our North American region, Mexico is doing its part through a series of far-reaching economic reforms, engaging with the U.S. through a high-level economic dialogue and with North America through the North American Leaders Summit process. President Peña Nieto's administration has sharp-headed a flurry of reforms encompassing labor, education, financial services, fiscal policy, competition policy, and telecommunications, and of course, energy. The common aim behind these reforms is to increase the productivity of the economy. Taken together, the reforms set the basis for sustained high rates of growth of the Mexican economy. These reforms are complemented by the National Infrastructure Plan, which involves approximately $590 billion US in public and private investment in over the next 5 years in more than 700 projects encompassing energy, communications, transportation, housing, urban development, health, and tourism. The showcase will be the new airport in Mexico City, which will be the largest airport in Latin America and a key hub connecting passengers and cargo with all regions of the globe. I can add here that we are at the edge of having a free skies agreement with the U.S. to be signed this year that will provoke, I suppose, an explosion, really a very positive explosion in terms of the possibilities of airplanes going from one side to the other of the Rio Grande. And while we are doing our homework, we must continue to engage with the U.S. and Canada to fully unleash the power of the Mexican economy. The rules established by our free trade framework, which ensured a predictable framework for business planning and investment, were state-of-the-art of the early 1990s, but we need to take into account transformations in technology, production and trade over the past decades to ensure that North American economic governance and infrastructure keep up with economic realities. As a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Commerce put it, we have a 19th century infrastructure with 20th century rules within the 21st century economy. So we have to do something. We need to streamline customs procedures and invest in infrastructure to reduce border wait times, which cost us billions of dollars per year. We must also work with the private sector to develop world-class logistics that reduce the costly friction of cross-border trade and boost the competitiveness of the region. We should not simply increase the number of border crossings by fiat. I was Director General for North America, and I was responsible for increasing with 3 new ports of entry. But now it's not only new ports of entry, but focus on improving the efficiency of crossing where trade flows are concentrated and trade volumes warrant improved infrastructure, more personnel, and longer operating hours. Through the Mexico-US high-level economic dialogue, which was launched during President Obama's visit to Mexico in May 2013, we were pursuing initiatives in areas, strategic areas, like logistic corridors, customs and border master plans, and air transportation, which will increase the competitiveness, again, of the region. We are also fostering economic growth and entrepreneurship through joint investment promotion, advanced manufacturing, and deepening regulatory cooperation. As production becomes increasingly regional, the transaction costs posted by different national regulations must be tackled head on. In addition to the high-level group, in May 2013, President Peña Nieto and Obama, agreed to create a bilateral forum of higher education, innovation, and research. FOBESI, we call it in the Spanish acronym. And it's the most important part of what I'm stressing here. Through this FOBESI, we are developing a shared vision for educational cooperation with a view to expanding economic opportunities in both countries and developing a workforce attuned to the needs of the 21st century economy. Further increases in productivity in the automobile and aerospace industries and across the value chains of the energy sector will require skilled North American workers that can meet the demands of the 21st century economy. I can say that in the 90s, both countries dedicated a lot of energy to commerce and trade, and we did a great job. In the 2000s, we did a decade dedicated to security and cooperation in security, and I think we did a good job. In the 2010s, what is next is the social human capital building in this region, and that's what is lacking. I was director for North America for many years, and with Enrique Berruga at that time, chatting having a good time at that moment, he asked me, what would you do for this relationship in the future? And I said, something that provokes familiarity between the two countries, something that provokes people going to the United States from Mexico. I would put a subject of Mexican history in U.S. schools and a subject of U.S. history in Mexican schools. And if I can go beyond, I was creative at that moment, I need an NFL and a baseball team in Mexico. And I need a football soccer in the women league in the U.S. and a football soccer team in the MLS. That would bring the plane full of people, full of stars, and that would provoke familiarity. And now I'm still with that idea, and if I could, I put someone, a very Mexican character, in those Netflix marvelous miniseries. A good Al Zapata could play a great play there. Through the North American Leader Summits, we are aiming to take what we began through the high-level group from the bilateral level to the trilateral level. These initiatives are an acknowledgement that our economies are not in a sum-zero game with each other, but rather are competing together as one unit in the global marketplace. As I have been stressing, our integration is not just economic. One of the most important contemporary challenges of Mexicans and Americans alike is the need to investigate our roots and see how both countries have been and continue to be shaped by migration. The histories of both our peoples are histories of movement, and that history shapes our contemporary lives and relationship to one another. In the last 20 years, Mexico migration flows to the United States have experienced a dramatic change. They have passed from a steady growth that peaked in 2007 to a downward trend that reached an almost net zero balance in 2010. Today is a negative migration. We are more Mexicans going back to Mexico than Mexicans coming to the U.S. But still there's a lot of migration because people go and come. And we have a lot of Central Americans going to Mexico and from Mexico to the U.S. because we are, as a region, still demanding a lot of people. And Mexico is demanding people, and the U.S. are demanding more people. These figures, when the construction sector of the U.S. starts growing steadily again, will provoke a net migration, now again, of Mexicans going to the U.S. The changing trends of migration flows from Mexico toward the U.S. are commonly attributed to a complex range of push and pull factors. For example, it is alleged that one of the key factors that drove the increase in Mexican migration at the end of the 20th century was the economic consequence of the Mexican recession and currency devaluation of 1995, at a time when the American economy was booming, while the challenging situation in Mexico pushed many of our nationals toward the United States. The economic development and expansion of the U.S. labor market pulled them. These pull and push factors have experienced a substantial transformation in the last 20 years. Some authors believe that the standstill in Mexican migration, the relation between Mexican entering to the returning from the U.S., is a consequence of immigration enforcement at the border and in the interior, a weakening U.S. labor market, especially in the housing construction sector, and most importantly, positive changes happening in Mexico, both demographic and economic. The Mexican baby boom, which contributed to increased migration to the United States, is over. In the middle 60s, Mexican women had an average of almost 6 children. Today, the average is 2 children. Changes in Mexico's demographic profile and decrease in immigration have had a significant impact on in these dynamics. Today, Mexico has an average of 27 years old. We have a real important demographic bonus, but that bonus is going to end. It's going to end in 15 years. In 15 years, Mexico will be a net importer of labor. We have to take advantage in this period of 15 years of this demographic bonus that we have at this moment. We are young, entrepreneurial, strong, active. That's what the Mexicans are. And we're the Mexicans in Mexico and the Mexicans in the U.S. But we're going to get older. Mexico is also taking care of its people. Well, we have become a predominantly middle-class country. The Brookings Institution has highlighted that 60% of Mexico's population is middle class, and by 2030, 86% of all Mexicans will have a middle class status. A couple of examples help illustrate this point. Since 1980, the number of Mexican students enrolled in higher education programs has tripled. and housing credit has increased more than 20-fold since the early 1970s. We have a new middle class that is there, and I think for Utah, for example, is a market to target immediately. These new migration trends poses new challenges and opportunities. While there are less Mexicans coming to the United States, most of those who do live in the country have lived here for over 10 years, making important contributions to the economy, culture, and society. In 2011, we were 270,000 individuals of Mexican origin in Utah. They are an integral part of Utah's economies, and they are taxpayers. They own property value at $984 million, have more than $1 billion in purchasing power, and paid more than $67 million in state and local taxes in the year 2000, according to the report of the Institute of Public and International Affairs at this university. In 2007, Mexican-owned firms had annual sales of $832 million and provided employment to 5,615 people in this state. As migration trends have changed, the migration narrative has also shifted. Today, the contribution of migrants and the need for immigration reform are widely acknowledged. States are moving away from the anti-immigrant legislation to instead promote more welcoming laws and policies. Utah has welcomed the opportunity offered by immigrants to its economy and communities. The state's understanding of immigration has changed, and now undocumented immigrants can access in-state tuition and obtain driving privileges. For the last 25 years, the government of Mexico has made continuous and systematic effort to engage in constructive and forward-looking relationship with Mexicans and Mexican-Americans living in the United States, building trustful and respectful relationship with national Hispanic organizations and being a key element of the government's strategy. And I have to acknowledge Consul Eduardo Arnal, who is with me and who has, I can tell you, one of the best we have in the lineup of all consuls of Mexico. As the gap between Mexico and its communities abroad has begun to close, the way in which the government approaches Hispanic organizations has changed as well. We not only ask them what we can do together, but also what the Mexican government can do for them. We recognize that Hispanics, particularly Mexicans and Mexican Americans in the United States, will serve as an important bridge to the future of the bilateral relationship between our two countries. And here we have a very Latin American vision. This is a forum about Latin America, and I would leave the possibility, if you ask me, to talk a little bit about the Pacific Alliance and some other mechanism that the Mexican government is fostering in order to have a better and more active relationship with all Latin America and even for Latin America here in the United States. In conclusion, with a forward-looking vision and decisive action, our two countries can build a closer relationship and turn North America into the most competitive region in the world. And every step forward we take in mutual understanding will pay dividends in the collaborative North American project that holds the key to a prosperous future for our peoples. Let me once again extend, and I'm very, very serious in that, all my gratitude to the Hinckley Institute of Politics for allowing me to share the Mexican view for the future of North America and the great opportunity that await us as a region. Thank you very much.
We will devote the remainder of the time to questions. If you have a question, please raise your hand, give us your name, a little bit of information about yourself, and briefly state your question. We have a question.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Kerry Gonzalez, and I am a student. I'm a PhD student in the Department of Language and Literature. And my question is going to be kind of like different, because it seems through your words and your speech that Mexico is doing very well and is doing very well in its relationships. And then you mentioned also the good reforms that Enrique Peña Nieto had done recently. But I think my perspective is a little bit different, because from what I know, one of those reforms actually favored one of the monopolies, such as Televisa. And also, I would like you, if you can, to respond, how do you balance, I mean, like, all this data of your speech with the reality that the country is living currently with the disappearance of 43 students, with all the situation that we are living about lack of trust in the government, all the corruption we see when people like Jose Murat owns properties in New York, when people probably that are here, no one can afford properties like that. So maybe for everyone here, it might look like this is not related to the subject, but for me, it is related because it's my country. And to me, it seems like there's not, I don't know, like, how do you balance your speech with the reality that Mexico is living right now? And obviously, it's affecting the projection that Mexico has internationally.
I'm very glad that, that the question comes. It's very, very important. Of course, there are many, many challenges and problems in Mexico. There are problems in human rights. There are problems in terms of law enforcement. The case that you raised is one of the most publicized in worldwide, and it's a terrible case in which a local authority absolutely involved with the organized crime, and in a horrible scenario decides to get rid and disappear 43 students in the state of Guerrero in Iguala. I would like to address this exactly with words. It has to be a balance, and the balance is very important here. Mexico faces a problem of human rights, a problem of local authorities that have not institutional power sufficient in this moment to provide to the old society security and tranquility in the way that we would like that is happening. At the same time, on the other side of the spectrum, we also have a problem of image. The level of violence in Mexico is not the best. We are about 17 killings, criminal killing among 100,000 people, which is better than many of your cities, better than New Orleans, better than Philadelphia, better than many other cities. Of course, Brazil has 30, Honduras has 80, so. And we, Mexico, as diplomats, have to go out and talk about this and say, although there's a huge problem in Mexico, we also have a problem of image, and we have to put all this in context. Because one death is terrible. One death is unacceptable. At the same time, it's difficult to accept that you are put as the peak of insecurity in the world when you are not the peak. You have a huge problem, but has to be a balance. As a representative of Mexico, what cannot go into my heart is the vision of depression, of we cannot do anything, or we have to get rid of the institutions. There are very strong institutions still there, and there's a lot of people that are really fighting for the possibility of a change. And that takes me to what is more important of your question from my point of view. The civil society, and that's why I was talking about the middle class in Mexico, the civil society in Mexico has grown in such a way that their big real change in my country is the way that any person in the government has to tackle and be aware of accountability. The governance is something that the Mexican society is asking. And it's asking very well. There's freedom of speech. You were talking about the monopolies in our media. Yes, one of our laws, telecommunications, enacted by the president, was exactly to give the teeth to the regulator in the area to provoke a change in the monopoly in the media. So that it was announced immediately after the law that the richest man in the world depends in the stakeholder of his assets in the U.S. market, Mr. Carlos Slim, decided not to be a relevant controller of a sector, and he decided to sell almost half of his action. So the result of the enactment of this law is going in the good direction. Of course, Televisa, the figures are there, is a company that will have less share in the market, and the possibility of a new broadcasting company in Mexico, after we Mexicans have lived with two for many years, is going to be there. So my belief is that the trend is positive and it's going okay mostly because of people like you, because of all these people that has been very critical, that goes to universities, that do the international scenario, that brings best practices from the international scenario and bring that to Mexico, and are very, very keen about criticizing, going ahead, and every word you said is very, very accepted by me. Yes, we have a big, big problem. Human rights, security is still there. Not so as terrible as is seen in the media, not so terrible as seen in the Mexican media, not even the international. We, Mexican media, is the toughest one. And at the same time, we should not think that that has to take us to depression or not to do something. The trend of the country is in the correct. The diagnosis is well done. And I'm believing that we are in that good trend. And of course, in that, Mexico-US relationship is a key factor for jobs, for economic growth, for all that, that has to be there and can provoke the economic development that the country needs. And I was talking about middle class. Yes, middle class is growing, and that is something that's happening. We are graduating 113 engineers per year, more than the US, more than Germany in Mexico. Some of them need skills, better skills in some areas, English, for example. We are going to be in an international energy market tomorrow. We need those Mexicans to be more relevant. So they will come to these kind of universities to prepare themselves so that they can go back to Mexico and provoke the complementary part of this change. Is the way I would try to put the balance in this. Yeah, thank
you. Another question?
Yeah.
My name's Dave. I practice law up in Bonneville County, Idaho, but I have a question. If an undocumented immigrant comes to the consulate here in Salt Lake City and they have no way to pay for medical care, does the consulate or does the Mexican government provide for the cost of the care? Because we had a forum on Thursday, and my understanding from the lady that works at the consulate is I understand the consulate will assist in helping an undocumented immigrant find medical services, but I'm not clear who bears the cost, assuming that immigrant is unable to pay him or herself. Who pays?
First of all, that cases are not so frequent as it sounds, but if it happens, of course, the consulate can help, but the consulate has a limit in that. The vision of a consulate cannot, because of the amount of people, can be case by case. It's more structural. So the consulate does a lot of things. And one of the big challenges for Mexicans in the U.S., we have seen figures that also in this balance, I will never try to make you believe that all Mexicans are in a very vulnerable position in terms of health and education. But if you see the standards, Mexicans, undocumented Mexicans, are among the groups that have more problems in terms of health, lack of health protection, although they are young in general and they do not get sick so frequently, and in education. So what we do is a lot of preventive health systems. Every consulate of Mexico has windows of health that provide for health consultation, but of course there are medical processes that are costly when someone is already sick that cannot be paid by the consulate. In emergency cases, the consulate can do something, but cannot be case by case because that would be a not ending story. But there's a huge program in the 51 consulates of Mexico in the U.S. dedicated to promote and help with health prevention. In education, we have a similar system. We have scholarships, systems of integration, communal organization to provoke students to go to school and have and complete the studies until high level, as we saw, as they are very, very keen of going to a higher level. So the consulates that are very active have the documentation part, the protection part, in which they try to put the old Mexicans in a not vulnerable situation, abiding the law, and of course these systems more in the area of prevention and health and education. But a case, single case, in which someone is sick, usually those Mexicans go to emergency areas in the hospital where they have to be assisted. and that I understand is debated and complicated sometimes for the community that are receiving them. The balance is that Mexicans provide much more in terms of paying taxes, paying social security, paying all that, what they consume in terms of going to the emergency halls in the hospitals. Much more what they pay or what they receive.
Well, I think you can make the argument that overall, there are pockets, and I can take you up to a little
next question. Mm-hmm. It's all radio. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I understand.
Hi. My name is Susan Vogel, and I'm co-founder of Artes de Mexico in Utah. Some of us here have trouble convincing our kids they're Mexican, like my daughter. How can, if we're going to fulfill this potential of people who are able to engage in business in Mexico, you've mentioned the importance of teaching Latin American or Mexican history. What can we do so that the kids, our kids, who are Mexican and American, how can they connect with Mexico in a way that develops their potential, not only intellectually, educationally, but culturally?
Every consulate has an officer dedicated to promote the community services, the community engagement with Mexico. There are many activities. Mexico is an example worldwide in those terms. We started in the early 90s with something called the Programa para las Comunidades Mexicanas en el Exterior. With different areas, sports, we organize the best football soccer championship in North America, in the amateur case, it's amazing. We, of course, have the cultural part, the different services for getting together people that have any kind of a similar Mexican activity, all that happens, and every consulate, here is the consul, can guide you to this officer who has to promote that. At the same time, I would recommend as well that Mexico is one of the third largest producer of technologies of information today. And part of that has been dedicated to cultural diffusion. So today the online services about Mexico are amazing. For example, if you want to learn Spanish, one of the best systems is developed by the UNAM, the Mexican National Autonomous University of Mexico, that has all, and we together with Instituto Cervantes are preparing the exam of a Spanish as a second language. All that is part of what I would recommend. But of course, in every consulate, there's a person that can help to promote also the cultural entities, nonprofit organizations that in every area are there and can, with differences, because they are free to, some of them are more politicized, more or less, but they usually have a great job in terms of diffusion, cultural activity, and provoking exactly what you're asking for, this attachment to the Mexican society.
Let me do the shift to the Spanish. Embajador, quisiera preguntarle si el gobierno mexicano tiene alguna estrategia dirigida a utilizar, en el mejor término de la palabra, a la comunidad latina en los Estados Unidos para que sirva de puente a la integración económica entre los Estados Unidos y México, en este caso, pues a los mexicoamericanos. Hace unos años el Departamento de Estado inició un programa en ese mismo sentido. No sé si ese programa ha continuado y quisiera que nos ilustrara un poquito, señor embajador, sobre cómo podría hacerse y cómo podrían los latinos y específicamente los mexicoamericanos contribuir, que viven acá, por supuesto, en los Estados Unidos, a esa integración económica. Gracias.
It's a very big question. Maybe you were not here when Javier made his statement about the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, and I will immediately talk about how is the Hispanic Chamber talking about the famous free trade for the Pacific, the TTP, because I was thinking how they can engage in this process that is very important for Mexico. So exactly this kind of meetings is the way we are trying to engage all the Mexican, Latino-oriented entrepreneurs, etc., to this integration. Sometimes it's not easy because some of those companies have already benefited from the relationship and start having an advantage so that they are not so keen about opening new areas. But in general, the vast majority at Al Zapata is here, dedicated all his time to that exactly, to provoke that the constituency of the Latino community goes in that direction. At the same time, I'm very, very confident and optimistic. The vast majority of new companies in the U.S. are explained by the entrepreneurship
filling of the Latino community. New companies are done by the Hispanic population, no by others, in the same level. At the same time, all of them really think and have a purchasing power that is enormously important. Mexican government organized twice a year a great event about Latino and Mexican production that can be sold in the U.S. and is every year more successful. Different companies go there, immediately get engaged with counterparts in Mexico and start facilitating the trade of all those products that are very appealing for the Latino community here and immediately provoke that kind of free trade. When someone asks me about the possibility of having an engagement in the relationship, I recommend, because of the maturity of the of this production change that I was explaining, that a product can cross many times in the border, etc., to have a counterpart in Mexico, or the contrary exactly. So we promote a lot of joint ventures. And today here in Utah, I heard about something that for me is the future of all this. And because of historical reasons, we Mexico were not so keen about it. But there are the starting of ventures and fund hedge funds dedicated to the relationship. For example, the famous NatBank, who was developed because of NAFTA in the border to promote projects more in the environmental sector in NAFTA, has been an underused bank. Really, we can go beyond the NatBank is present. We need a real North American bank. We need this financial sector more dedicated to the region to fund all these projects that are there. So I heard that in Monterrey, something called ALTA, is a new strategy in which these hedge funds can really show to the business people the attractiveness of the projects in infrastructure, in new bridges, in all that, so that it's easier for companies to get the money that they need to develop in a better way. So I think this financial sector is something that is still starting, but will become a key player for the future. I think we have to end here. Okay. I would love to go on with many other questions, but let me reassure my thank for all of you for being here and be so interested in this Mexico-US relationship. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for being here today. And I see many of you have come to many of our 21 events to explore the future of U.S.-Latin American relations that have been everything from documentary films to incredible speakers, to our ambassador, who is doing some incredible things today. We have him literally scheduled, as Eduardo knows, from about 6:30 a.m. today until about midnight tonight, and most all day tomorrow, meeting with all sorts of different communities, going to another university who's been a partner with us on some of these activities. Part of it was to highlight this incredible region of which we are a part. Part of it was as well to reemphasize what the Governor's Office of Economic Development and World Trade Center are doing. There's a huge focus on Latin America. Both of our governor's trade missions last year were to Latin America, Mexico, and to Brazil. And finally, to the University of Utah and Brigham Young University, which had a joint application and received the most prestigious federal grant, Title VI funding, on their joint Latin American studies. So there's a lot of energy here in Utah, and we are so grateful for the ambassador to come and share so much of himself and the consul staff and everyone that Al thanked deserved it. With that, I hope you will all get to the Marriott Library to see this incredible exhibit, which was mentioned, and here's a book to commemorate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Great exposition. I recommend it.